Welcome back to The Horse Race, your end-of-year look at the greatest politics, policy, and elections in Massachusetts. I'm Steve Cazella, president of the Massing Polling Group.
And I'm Stephanie Murray, author of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook. And today is our last episode of 2019, and it's also our last episode of the decade. So pop the champagne, Steve.
Yes, we have the champagne right over there in our horse race theme, horse race branded ice bucket that we keep in the corner. No, that is crazy, actually. I hadn't actually contemplated that this is the end of the decade.
It's very, very exciting. What were you doing a decade ago, Steve?
2009, I guess I was still probably at the State Department, and 2010 is when we founded the polling group. So almost 10 years. Next year will be our 10-year anniversary of founding the Massing Polling Group.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I was graduating middle school 10 years ago.
Thank you. Was that intentional?
Or no.
Just, okay. All right.
Anyways.
Yes, but it is also the end of our third calendar year here at the horse race, which actually started in 2017. That's also kind of amazing that the horse race has been galloping for that long, that we've taken that many laps.
Three laps around the track,
yeah,
I would
say. Yeah, I don't know what the right metaphor would be. But unfortunately, it's not all happiness and holidays today. It's also impeachment day. As we meet here today in the pod bunker, the House is debating articles of impeachment on the floor. It seems like that vote is sort of a foregone conclusion, but there's obviously a lot of drama to come. Stephanie, I know you've been following how the Massachusetts delegation is responding to all this. So give us a sense of what's going on there.
Sure. I mean, Congressman Jim McGovern, he's chairman of the Rules Committee. He's kind of been the one quarterbacking the rules for this, how it's going to happen, what the rules for the debate are going to be. He talked for a pretty long time this morning about how he views this as a constitutional duty, not a political decision. Congresswoman Catherine Clark also expected to speak on the House floor today, and I think probably a lot of other members of the delegation if they haven't spoken already. I think there were 6 hours of debate scheduled today for this impeachment vote. And then from there, it looks like we're headed for a trial in the Senate. I mean, it's not clear to me whether the Senate will remove the president. Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham have said that they're not going to do that. But the other thing to look at is whether a Senate trial will pull the senators running for president off the 2020 campaign trail, which is almost certain.
Yeah, we've also seen already this morning Joe Kennedy read a letter to his children into the record, sort of explaining why he was voting that way. We're seeing others sort of issuing statements showing up on Twitter. Steve Lynch, I know, put out a statement yesterday or the day before. So all the Massachusetts delegation seems like they're weighing in one by one. I guess I'm a bit more cynical about what the Senate's probably going to do. It doesn't seem I have not seen any indication of sort of divisions within the ranks other than maybe one or two senators, maybe Mitt Romney, maybe a couple others, but not anything, probably zero, and not anything approaching what would be required to actually remove him. So that's, I guess, my more cynical view.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to understate the gravity of this moment. I mean, we're living through the third impeachment in American history. This will be in the history books. I mean, it's been going on for so long, and it's kind of just the water that we've been swimming in. But I think it's important to remember the gravity of what's happening today.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I mean, it is easy to get cynical, and I just sort of described my own reaction as cynical. But you're right, and perhaps that's a good cautionary note to not underestimate sort of how some people might react and whether eventually they'll sort of be grabbed by the gravity of the moment. It just seems now like leaders are watching what the voters do and whether, you know, the polls change, and voters are watching what their leaders do, and, you know, everybody's sort of waiting for somebody else to do something. So that, I think, just leaves the sort of very polarized reality in place where, you know, Republicans seem unified against it, Democrats seem mostly unified for it, and that's just where it is.
You're totally right, Steve. I feel like we're in kind of like this feedback loop with cable news and social media and over and over again, and the polling, and it's all just like, it's like you said, it's just really polarizing. But there's also some other news coming out of Congress yesterday that we've been following pretty closely. Congresswoman Lori Trahan, a complaint into her campaign finance practices, is going to be investigated by the House Committee on Ethics. It's like a continuation of an investigation that they've been doing for several months. And the details in the report, even though they don't indicate whether she's guilty or not, I mean, it's not any indication of guilt. I mean, they're pretty pretty serious allegations.
Yeah, just for people who haven't been listening to The Horse Race in a while or don't have all of our episodes memorized.
How dare you?
First of all, how dare you? Rectify that immediately. But also just remind people sort of what the issue is here, because it's not cut and dried exactly even
it's
what happened.
It's pretty confusing, yeah.
It's just sort of what the basics are and now what this investigation is looking into.
So at the heart of the issue here is a loan that Lori Trahan made to her campaign in the final days of the 2018 Democratic primary back last September, and then she ended up winning the race by a very, very narrow margin of votes. I think it was around 150 votes. And there have been questions about whether the money she loaned her campaign came from her own account, whether it came from a joint account with her husband that they shared, or whether the money just came from her husband or her husband's business. And so that's what the committee has been looking at. And this report that we got yesterday alleges that Trahan might have backdated checks and her husband might have taken money from his business and put it into a joint account that they share. So it's kind of this very muddled and confusing bit of election law. It's not clear to me what's going to happen, but Trahan's office has been pushing back on it pretty hard, saying the Office of Congressional Ethics cherry-picked the details. They put her personal banking information out there when they shouldn't have, so they're fighting it pretty hard.
But the vote to go forward was 5 votes in favor and 1 abstention, right? I mean, this was not divided. It's not partisan in this case. It's everybody saying that this should go forward.
That's correct.
So some questions that I've gotten about this, and honestly, I share some of them myself, is it seems like it's just like which pocket was the money in? You know, these are family accounts, and it's Lori Trahan's husband where the money may have come from, if that's what the investigation reveals. So what's the big deal? I guess that's the easiest way of putting that question.
I think it's a great question. I mean, either the money came from Trahan's personal account, her joint account with her husband, or her husband. I mean, if it came just from her husband, there are laws, even your spouse can't give you over the federal contribution limit. And I mean, as Dan Coe, who Trahan beat pretty narrowly last year, weighs running for Congress, he's kind of waiting in the wings, breathing down her neck. It's not clear to me whether voters are really going to care about kind of a confusing bit of campaign finance law that might not even, you know, yeah, it's like, exactly. It's pretty muddy, but she could get punished in some way with a fine or something like that, or have to apologize by the committee, which would be pretty tough for her as a freshman lawmaker.
Yeah, it seems like with all the crazy ways that our campaign finance system works and, you know, super PACs and giant piles of money sort of, you know, cascading in every direction, that this particular rule, I guess this is on the one side, is sort of silly. On the other side, you have to follow the rules. And every campaign, down to the smallest local election, will tell you that campaign finance rules are the quickest way to get yourself into yourself and your campaign into trouble.
So we'll keep an eye on that. I mean, the committee doesn't have any timeline that they need to follow, so we're not sure like when the next development will happen, but we'll keep an eye on it.
We'll keep an eye on that. And in the intervening period, we have to ask ourselves a question we always do, which is the existential one. Why are we here?
For the last time in 2019. So first up, we've got Alan Casey, who is a candidate running in the 4th Congressional District to replace Congressman Joe Kennedy. And Steve and I are also going to look ahead to 2020, the year you've been hearing about forever, and count down the biggest stories of 2019.
As 2019 comes to a close and holiday traditions abound, we're building on our tradition of meeting the many candidates running for the Massachusetts 4th Congressional District. Today, our guest is the co-founder of nonprofits City Year and Democracy Entrepreneurs. Alan Casey joins us today to talk about his ideas and the race ahead. Thank you for coming on The Horse Race.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
So the basic question that we've been asking all the candidates to start is, why are you running for Congress and why now? Why this moment?
Sure. Well, I'm running because my whole life has been about service. As you mentioned, I started City Year. I've started several nonprofits. City Year is a national service program that unites young people to do a year of service. And this opportunity to serve the people of the 4th District is a dream of mine. You know, I want to help people on issues of health care, on climate change, on transportation. I was just meeting with State Representative Paul Schmidt about Fall River. I want to help with the economic turnaround in Fall River and how we bring it to the 21st century. And for this moment, so I want to be the person people turn to for their veterans benefits, their Medicare, their Medicaid, their student loans, et cetera. But for this moment in particular for me, I've been a movement leader. I've been an entrepreneur for me, it's the worst of times and the best of times. It's the worst of times because of Donald Trump. And we don't have to go into that. We all know he's an existential threat. But for me, it's the best of times because of the way people have responded. I was very involved in the Women's March. I helped organize the Boston March just steps from here. 175,000 people showed up. I helped also organize something called the Sister March Network, where we united the 640. We started with 12. Once we started Boston, we started reaching out to others. We got 12 on a conference call. By then, we had 645. I was very involved with March for Our Lives, these extraordinary high school students who finally have the NRA on their heels. All this new activism, I think, is the opportunity to restore our democracy, to bring the people back in, get the special interests out of Congress, and break the logjam. And I have, I think, a unique skill set in that, and I'm inspired about how we, the people, are responding, and that's why I'm running.
Alan, so you mentioned Donald Trump, but I mean, as we sit here today, we can't really ignore what's happening in Washington, D.C. I mean, as we speak, the House is debating whether to vote to impeach President Donald Trump. There's not really any sign that the Senate is going to move and decide to remove him. So what does this division and this divisiveness mean for the country?
Well, I think the House is doing its constitutional responsibility. It's really clear. He is the most corrupt, amoral president we've ever had. And he's using the office to make himself richer, to make his kids richer. So they're doing what they have to do. The Senate, which is led by, you know, Mitch McConnell, is not going to take this seriously. I mean, already they've said they're not going to do a fair trial. They've already decided what they're going to do. Ultimately, and this is what I've been talking about, is we the people have to remove Donald Trump. And that's why I'm inspired by March for Our Lives and the registering young people to vote. That's why I'm inspired by all the new activism. I want to be a different kind of leader. I've been a different kind of leader as a social entrepreneur, as an entrepreneur, as a movement leader. I've gotten things done in a different kind of way, and I believe that that's what it's going to take. It's not going to take the same hold. And in terms of bringing us together, well, that's been my life's national service. You know, one of the issues I'm going to push really hard, I already worked with Senator Kennedy and Senator Hatch and Senator McCain and President Obama to get the Kennedy Serve America Act passed into law. It was the last legislation that Senator Kennedy did. It hasn't been funded. That's because, sadly, after Senator Kennedy passed, there was nobody in there pushing hard to say, this is a top priority. I will do that. We need universal national service, voluntary, at scale. I believe if we had had universal national service 20 years ago, a million people a year serving, Donald Trump would not be president today because he couldn't vilify and divide because we'd know each other. Because national service brings people from all different backgrounds, different racial and ethnic backgrounds, different socioeconomic levels, different faiths, different religions, different parts of the country. And that's going to be a top priority for me. And it's the way to heal the country after we get rid of Trump. Because at the end of the day, we do have more that brings us together than divides us. But he's a villain at the divide and conquer, stoking misogyny, anti-LGBTQ, racism. And so I actually think I have a strategy to deal with that.
So let's talk then a bit about the details of that policy, because that's one we don't hear come up a lot. You know,
sure.
We sort of listen to the debates and we hear Medicare for All, we hear about gun legislation, and I know you have views on those as well, mm-hmm. But national service is something that many people may not be familiar with, other than sort of in a military context. So describe for those people that may not have heard as much about it, what it is exactly, how your proposal and how the legislation that's currently not funded would work.
Sure. Well, Steve, it's... So it's been around for a long time, actually. I mean, we started City Year 32 years ago. City Year unites young people ages 17 to 24 for a year of full-time national service working in inner-city public schools, helping kids graduate. There are now and we were the model for the AmeriCorps program, which has hundreds of programs working on every issue you can imagine, the opioid crisis, environment, fighting poverty, hunger, et cetera. So here's my different idea now and what I want to do in the next step. I want to take the children's savings account idea, which Deb Goldberg just made universal in Massachusetts, and tie it to national service. Here's how it would work. For every young person born in this country, I don't know if you guys are familiar with 529 accounts.
Sure.
I mean, I've got a 17-year-old and an 11-year-old, so, you know, we've been saving. It's not nearly enough, I mean, because the cost of higher education is crazy. So I want to take that idea, but tie it to national service and make it more universal. So what I'm proposing is... When a baby's born in America, the federal government will invest $11,000 into the equivalent of a 529 account, but I want to call it the American Dream Service Account. That money grows you know, in a managed account, just like 529s, and at sort of average returns, it can be as much as $50,000 by the time a young person turns 19. Now, families can contribute, just like, you know, with our kids, our, you know, their grandparents contribute, et cetera. And even $500 a year, it can get up to $70,000-$75,000. But here's the kicker. To get the federal investment, you have to do a year of national service. I can tell you, and it's a way to get at the crazy college costs, but I also want to make the American dream. So you could use it for higher education. You could use it for the down payment for your first home. You could use it for if you want to get certified in a trade. You could use it for to be a small business, a social entrepreneur, because people need startup funds. You could even save some of it for your retirement savings, because even if you put $1,000 away when you're 22, it gets to hundreds of thousands of dollars because of the value of compound interest. It would also be a lifelong account. So, I mean, this generation, my daughter's generation, they're going to have 8 or 9 jobs. They're not going to be like my grandparents' generation where you join one job and that's it. You could also use it for lifelong learning. It's a way to tie service with the number one issue. The reason we have such economic challenges, people don't have assets. Almost half the country is $500 away from a disaster. Their car breaks down, or a kid gets sick, or their heat breaks. And so this is a way to start every single young person with $50,000 that's theirs to use if they're willing to serve the country. And so I think if we did that, A, we get at the asset problem, and B, we spark. I can tell you, I can't imagine any young person. My daughter's 17 now. Now, she's a service person anyway because she's my daughter, and my wife also started a service program. But if there was $50,000 in an account for her as we're looking at college now, we'd say, Mirabel, we love you sometime. And it would be between ages 18 to 28. So you could do it before school, after high school. You could do it during college, after college. You could even go to law school and be a legal aid lawyer for a year to access your service bond. I think if we did that, A, we'd spark a service revolution. B, we would get at this underlying issue of the lack of assets for people. It's like a bookend to Social Security. It's a big democratic progressive idea. Before Social Security, elderly poverty was the worst. Now it's the least. Why don't we jumpstart young people? Why don't we have something that gets them going? We take care of people at the end of life, which we should do. Let's jumpstart young people with a new idea.
So we're talking a lot about what you would do in the future if you end up in Congress. But I want to kind of change gears a little bit and talk about the past. Voters know you.
Yes.
You ran for Senate in 2010 and again in 2012. And you were kind of like the original no corporate PAC pledge person. I mean, what do you think about how that idea has caught on and how it's caught fire in the presidential race and the Senate primary here, other races? Can you talk about that?
I love it. I mean, again, one of my priorities is democracy reform. And when I ran 10 years ago, I said, even though I was the least well-known, I had the least network, and people said, you're nuts, you're giving up all that potential money. I said, well, you can't go and reform the place. You can't get the special interest money out if you take their money to get elected. So I was, I think, among the first congressional candidates to say I wouldn't take any corporate PAC or lobbyist money. And now it's become a litmus test, which I'm really gratified by. I think, you know, and it's because of the people. You know, Citizens United and all this money in politics and the Koch brothers, you know, grassroots people are saying, get this out of here. And nothing gets done. The reason we don't solve the healthcare prescription drug crisis, which is ridiculous that we can't negotiate when we're the biggest buyer, Medicare, Medicaid, is because of the farm industry. The reason we don't deal with climate change is because of the fossil fuel industry. The reason we don't deal with guns is because of the stranglehold the NRA has. So I've continued that pledge. I think it's really important, and I'm glad that now people are rallying behind it. You really can't run as a Democrat now. We got to work on the Republicans, but at least in the Democratic Party, you can't run if you're taking that money. And you shouldn't take it because it does. Let me tell you, I have enough friends who've served in Congress. It makes a difference. Who's in there? They get in. They write the rules. They write the laws. It's insane. So I'll be a champion on that. I have a track record on it. And I'm going to fight like hell to get the special interests out of the Congress.
All right. Well, Alan Casey, candidate for the 4th Congressional District, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you all very much.
Like we mentioned earlier, this is our last episode of 2019. It's been a very tumultuous year in national politics, and with more than a few uproars here in Massachusetts as well. Looking ahead to 2020, there's no sign things will slow down. Actually, I'm pretty sure that they're about to speed up. We're here to set the scene for you with a sneak peek at the elections and issues that will dominate the year ahead.
I honestly can barely even contemplate the idea of speeding up from sort of the pace that we've been at.
Well, buckle in, Steve. It's about to get crazy.
I know what's going to happen, but like, I suppose I should say that every year since maybe 2015, there's been the tweet, which is like, people will just tweet the year, you know, this is 2015, this is 2016. Like, this is as crazy as it could possibly get is the implication.
I wonder if this will be the speed that we're always at, or if this year will be a particular anomaly.
Yeah, I hope not. I really do sort of hope that like 2021, 22, we can all just sort of tune out of national politics for a little while and get back to the things we're focused on here. But 2020 does, as you mentioned, sort of bring a bunch of stuff both at the national and the state level, starting right off with a bang, which is impeachment hearings. Unless something weird happens and we haven't checked our phones in the last 15 minutes, we're about to see the impeachment articles passed for Donald Trump. So then that'll head over to the Senate. And that it looks like that's going to happen sort of at the beginning of the year, the trial in the Senate.
And here at home, I mean, the impeachment trial in the Senate raises a lot of questions for Senator Elizabeth Warren. I mean, Iowa, New Hampshire, these early states that she's really got to win, she might be taken off the trail along with all of the other senators in the race to sit silently in the Senate and sit around for this trial when she could be on the trail doing retail politics. And I mean, polls show her what, in around second or third place, depending on what you look at and what you see. So this is crunch time for everybody, but especially her.
Yeah, it's her polls certainly have been weaker just in the last few weeks than they were before that. So it's not, the timing is not ideal for her. Of course, it would affect the other senators that are running as well. So, you know, you'd see a couple of people both in the top tier, Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, and those further down who would basically not be available for campaigning.
Also Joe Biden. His son is at kind of the center of this Ukraine situation that they're going to be talking about in the impeachment trial. I'm not sure what that means for him either.
Yeah, so that could have a big impact. And of course, we can't even move on to what the next thing to happen in the national level is, because we're also going to have a crazy January here in Massachusetts. So what are the things that we're looking forward to there?
I mean, maybe Beacon Hill will finally debate transportation after derailments and the worst traffic in the country. I mean, it seems like there's a lot of political will and frustration over the state's transportation system. So maybe that'll happen.
Yeah, we've seen just yesterday, actually, we saw the details of that, of the new gas importer fee, that Transportation and Climate Initiative, that bill came out. So that could potentially be on the docket. There's also the possibility of a climate and energy bill in the Senate specifically. That's something that Senator Mark Pacheco has been pushing for. And the Senate president seems to be suggesting January might be a time frame for that to start being considered as well.
And on top of that, the legislature's housing committee is polling members on a whole slew of housing bills this week, including the governor's housing bill, which would make it easier for communities like towns and cities to make zoning changes. And that's something that he's really worked hard on. So housing might be on the horizon for January or February as well.
So that craziness will be happening in January. That, I should say, very busy schedule, all interesting stuff. But that then runs us up to the beginning of February when we start talking about caucuses and primaries.
They're finally here.
Finally, and I'd also say already, because it seemed almost like there was this sudden transition where it was, oh, it's way too early. You know, how can we be talking about this? To wait a minute, it's in like 6 weeks.
Yep.
You know, there was no sort of approach time. It was like it was approaching and then suddenly it hit us in the face.
Yes, there was no time where we were like, this is the perfect distance between now and the Iowa caucus.
Yeah, so we're talking about 5 and 6 weeks away for Iowa and New Hampshire. And that'll be hitting February 3rd for Iowa and February 11th for New Hampshire. Of course, that also has implications for Massachusetts because we have currently 3, previously 4 candidates in the contest.
5, if you count Medford native New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg, even though he's not running in those early states. But the thing that I'm going to be watching out for in New Hampshire especially is Elizabeth Warren versus Deval Patrick, both from neighboring Massachusetts. And Patrick has been hitting Warren, or not by name, but he's been kind of going after, saying there are candidates that have plans, he has results, things like that. So I wonder if that line of rhetoric will knock a few points off her in New Hampshire and go to him.
Yeah, there's been a lot of candidates sort of focusing their fire on Elizabeth Warren, or they had been. Deval Patrick, the polls so far haven't shown that he's gained much traction. But, you know, the thing I think to note about New Hampshire is just that it's a state where often the polls move at the last minute. There's lots of attention being paid. The candidates all spend hours, days, weeks there sort of in the lead up. So you can see candidates suddenly rise in January.
And that's part of the culture in New Hampshire, too. Right? Voters don't want to be decided till the very last minute. They want to kind of keep their cards close to the close to the vest.
And an economic issue, because it's billions of dollars to the economy. So,
but that will soon be over, and then the spotlight will focus partially on Massachusetts for Super Tuesday.
That's right. Massachusetts votes on March 3rd. That's Super Tuesday. We're actually also going to have a couple special elections here in Massachusetts that same day. But Super Tuesday is March 3rd. States all over the country will be voting, and Massachusetts is one of them. I've often thought that candidates honestly focus too little on Massachusetts, because it is so soon after New Hampshire, and it's right here. And why don't people come here to campaign?
Well, I mean, Boston is the top media spending market right now, which is mostly from Tom Steyer and Mike Bloomberg. But Joe Biden just opened a campaign office in Massachusetts. Warren has two campaign offices separate from her HQ. So candidates are kind of starting to put down roots here and sort of make a bet that they're going to last through those early states and make it to Super Tuesday. But my big question mark is what Bernie Sanders is going to do, because he did very well here in 2016. He only lost to Hillary Clinton by like less than 2% of the vote. He only got one fewer delegate than her. And it seems to me like he hasn't really put down the roots here that you'd expect from somebody who had such support before.
Yeah, so with that then in March, that's something we'll be watching, is sort of how the candidates do all approach Massachusetts. A lot of the media spending, my guess is that it's mostly New Hampshire, you know, because a lot of Southern New Hampshire's in the Boston media market, you know, it sort of overlaps some of the more populated parts of New Hampshire. But maybe they will. Maybe candidates will suddenly decide they love Massachusetts and they care all about what we're doing here.
I think it's like an unintended benefit to them that we see all of their political ads all the time, every time we turn on our TVs.
Yeah, that could be.
At all.
So then after that, we have a bunch of other states voting, sort of the run-up to having a nominee. So if it were to go the distance, we'd have June 2nd is the last primary. June 6th is the last caucus. That's the all-important U.S. Virgin Island caucus on June 6th.
It seems so long from now. To that. Oh my God.
But just think, if it comes down to that, then like you could potentially be sent on assignment to, you know, the U.S. Virgin Islands.
Yeah, I might have to talk to my editor about that sooner than later. Call some dibs.
There's also then the end of session right there, which there's always the huge pile up of bills that have languished or that have been in development and the legislature tries to jam through at the last minute.
And the budget. Will it be on time?
Yes.
Will it be late? Will it last into 2021?
I would take a bet on that.
I'll use some money from that bet to go cover the Virgin Islands. So that brings us to July, which is when the conventions are. So the Democrats will gather in Milwaukee, and in August, the Republicans will gather in Charlotte, North Carolina.
That's right. Of course, a lot of eyes on how the Democrats do in Wisconsin next year. You know, it was a crucial state last time. It'll be a crucial state again this time. I'm not just saying that because I'm from Milwaukee. I honestly do believe that. but, you know, we should all love Wisconsin. But that then brings us through July and August. And then in September, we'll also be seeing the end of a campaign which will have been happening in July and August. And that, of course, is the huge Massachusetts Senate primary.
Do you feel like that is far away or too soon, Steve?
Right now, I feel like it's far away, but it's probably going to be with all this stuff going on, it like suddenly is upon us. And also because there's a bunch of other primaries that are happening too. We just heard from Alan Casey, who's running in the growing 4th Congressional District field. An analysis that Libby and I did earlier this year showed that we've got already the most competitive congressional primaries that we've had in decades here in Massachusetts. So a lot will be happening in September.
And I think it's hard to understate how big this Senate primary is going to be. The race has been kind of sleepy right now. They haven't done debates yet. They've kind of been going back and forth with these pledges about operational stuff. But Ed Markey has his seat on the line. Joe Kennedy has his reputation on the line. This is going to be a blockbuster, expensive, crazy race that is going to divide a lot of people, and it already has. So that's what I'm looking out for the most right now.
Yeah, so that'll be a big story next year, too, as people lining up for that one. And, of course, Shannon Liss Reardon as well running for that seat. There's also going to be just a bunch of other, I think, progressive primaries in September. Then in the obviously in the September and October time period, we've got the end of the presidential campaign, which is going
surprise.
To be nuts. It's going to be nuts. I say that in an excited way, because otherwise I would cry, because it's going to be ugly. But anyway, so it's going to be an absolutely crazy year ahead in Massachusetts and national politics, and we'll be right here covering it for
yes,
you.
Yes, we will. So that was a pretty long list. I hope you've been taking notes, but let's move now to looking back at 2019 before we forget it all and barrel into 2020.
So as this is our final episode of 2019, we wanted to end on a note of Mapley nostalgia. So we took to Twitter and asked you, our dear listeners, what was your favorite Massachusetts politics or policy moment of 2019? We ran them all through our elaborate and proprietary deep learning AI algorithm to determine the definitive top five moments here in our great land.
Yes, we did. And ringing in at number five, this was from Jane Rayburn, and this is the Fall River mayoral... How would you explain
saga?
It?
I don't think election saga. is the right word. No, this, of course, is where there was an election where the mayor of Fall River, Jaisal Correa, was recalled. He was put on the ballot to be recalled and then reelected on the same ballot because there was also on the ballot people who could run to replace him, and he ended up replacing himself. So that was... weird. I don't know what
the right term before is. That he had been arrested for allegedly mishandling money that he had taken from investors for an app. After he was recalled, he was arrested again for allegedly extorting marijuana companies. And then he finally lost, but he did try to wage a sort of write-in campaign to like pad the vote and help himself win. But he is still collecting a city paycheck until January.
So Jaisal Correa, no longer the mayor of Fall River, but definitely a saga. So thank you, Jane Rayburn, for that nomination. At number four, we have a nomination from Christopher Freis on Twitter. Apologize, Christopher, if I mispronounce your last name. He suggested the one-vote Boston City Council at-large win.
So that, of course, was the fourth Boston City Council at-large seat. Was so close that they had to go to a recount. It was between Julia Mejia and Alejandra St. Guillen. The distance between them was around 10 votes. It ended up being only one vote when they finished the recount. So either way, the city council has its first Latina member, but it was just this weeks-long, really tense process. But it seemed like they were able to kind of work it out and get along throughout the whole thing, which impressed me.
Yeah, the candidates comported themselves in a way that I think we can all admire. But it's, you know, anytime you have to ask yourself, does my vote matter? Well, you know, there was the Boston City Council recount.
One vote!
One vote, so it does. So at number three, we have one that we put in. Stephanie, what do we have at number three?
Everybody in Massachusetts running for president. Let's go down the list. Elizabeth Warren, Deval Patrick, Bill Weld, Seth Moulton, Medford native Michael Bloomberg. Who else? Oh, Bill de Blasio went to Cambridge, Ringen Latin. And Mike Gravel has some Massachusetts ties. And the person that I go to when I talk about all of these people from Massachusetts running for president is Nick from Boston.com, who always has the best list of everybody with Massachusetts ties.
So that was number three. And then number two was, I think, the biggest legislative story of the year here in Massachusetts. And of course, that was the education reform bill. This is something that's been coming for a long time. It's significant new money for the public education system here in Massachusetts, makes some changes to sort of how that funding is allocated, was celebrated on the progressive side as a really major, major shift in education policy and an updating of some of the systems that we put in a couple of decades ago now.
And this was something that lawmakers have been working on since 2015. So for almost half a decade. It was back in 2015 that the Foundation Budget Review Commission found the state was underfunding education by so much. And it's taken this long to do it. After a really tense stalemate at the end of last session, they were able to do it. So a big win for a lot of people on Beacon Hill.
Absolutely. And then number one, because this one explains just so much about where we are, is a nomination from Ed Lyons. And that, of course, is the Red Line derailment. And I think the AI deep learning algorithm chose that as number one. because it's emblematic of so many things. I mean, the Orange Line has been in big trouble these last few weeks. We've had shutdowns in major parts of the system. There have been track fires, bus fires, derailments on the Orange, Green, and Red Lines. You know, we've got the highest number of derailments in the country. You've got the safety report that just came out in the last week that I think identified some pretty troubling issues about how the agency's approaching safety. It's emblematic of so many things that are impacting the T right now.
I think it was the Boston Globe who called the Red Line derailment and all of these transportation problems back in July or August or whenever it was. They called it the summer of our discontent with transportation. And I loved that, but now it doesn't fit because everything has continued to be terrible with transportation. So it's just the year of our discontent, I guess.
Yeah, it's also I would assume that it's number one because there's it impacts what's going to happen next year. You know, the legislature has suggested that it may take it up in some way, at least on the House side. You know, Charlie Baker has sort of hitched his wagon, so to speak, to TCI and the money that could come from that. And there's just a lot of questions about how much should be spent on different things, what things we should be investing in, how we should sort of approach this going forward. But I think one thing is clear is that transportation in Boston is not working. It is not working. It's not on its way to working. It's just terrible. And it's become a threat that I think is, I guess I'd say existential. Is that saying too much?
I completely agree with you. And I think that everybody else agrees too, that transportation is in a dire state, from the T to traffic to regional transportation systems and other parts of the state. Everybody agrees it's a problem. Nobody can agree how to fix it.
Yeah, maybe that's the crux of the issue. But thank you to everybody who nominated things. Just some other things that people nominated. We had Josh Gee, who just said traffic, getting back to what we were just talking about. We had the story of D.A. Rollins and Marianne Ryan, the district attorney from Middlesex County, suing Immigration and Customs Enforcement and getting them booted out of courts. We had some things on the Encore Casino, ranked choice voting, a whole bunch of different stuff. So thank you to all of our listeners for sending their nominations.
And as we head out of 2019, we want to say thank you all for listening to this podcast and sticking with us. As we transition into the new year, we want to hear from you. What do you want to hear more of in 2020? Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or send your thoughts to thehorseracepodcast@gmail.com. You can send us your horse race holiday wish list, if you will. Or your resolutions.
That sounds amazing. Please do send us your resolutions. We'll read them maybe in December of next year, and you can tell us whether you kept them. But for now, our personal favorite, perhaps not the most consequential development in 2019, is the resurrection of the Massachusetts State Polka. our dear co-host, Jennifer Smith, in an act of what I would call heroic public service journalism, restored it to the internet. So now, as a special holiday gift to you, and to take you through to the next year, once again, Lenny Gamolka and the Chicago Push with Say Hello to Someone from Massachusetts.
Say hello to someone in Massachusetts. Tip your hat to every lady that you meet. Shake a hand, you'll make a friend in Massachusetts. Not New England, old-time custom can't be beat.